and welcome to Worlds Apart. A few years back, it would have seemed like a grotesque sketch, but kowtowing to the daddy in Washington now seems to be a conscious foreign policy choice for Europe's elites. The more resentful they are of Russia, the more fawning they seem to become of the United States, despite the ostentatious contempt of the latter. Where is it leading the European project? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ulrike Geroth, founder of the European Democracy Lab. Ulrike, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's been a couple of weeks since that landmark meeting between President Trump and President Putin in Alaska and the subsequent summoning of the Europeans and the Ukrainians to Washington. The fervor has had time to settle. Some conclusions have been drawn. What's your take? Do you think this series of diplomatic engagements have changed anything in the larger scheme of things?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that the meeting Trump-Putin has changed something on the very sort of level of atmosphere, the way that they took a car together and then they visibly understood quite well was a sign that there is a Russian-American understanding about ending this proxy war. And then it sounded a little bit, even seen from the European side, as a strange intervention that the European sort of heads and state flew behind with Zelensky to, in a way, torpedo the understanding. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously there is different commentating in European media, mm-hmm. because most European media say they are disappointed of Trump and Trump is betraying the European interest, yeah? But the other way to see it, and there are many Europeans who see it that way, is that European was ridiculizing itself mm-hmm. and that Europeans were basically torpedoing peace talks between mm-hmm. Russia and mm-hmm. the US.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there is some displeasure, I guess, in the European capitals about Trump abandoning European interests. And I think Trump himself is very open about it. I mean, a number of American observers, including John Mearsheimer, concluded that Trump is distinctly distancing himself from the conflict and openly passing it to the Europeans at their own expense. Do you think the Europeans are ready for such an inheritance? If they wanted this war so much, are they ready to, you know, deal with it on their own terms and with their own money?
And there are many observers who are now fearful that in a way the Americans could sneak out of the peace arrangements. Yeah, I mean, that the Americans could just drop the thing and say, look, you Europeans, you do this now. And if you are happy to go to war with Russia, then do what you want. But the Americans are out. Yeah, because we have wasted enough energy and money and so on and so forth. And again, for Europe, I think that this would be a very, very bad, a very bad thing. Because why? The other aspect is that there's no such thing than Europe. I mean, Europe, as you have been seen in the European meeting, yeah, when Mrs. Meloni started rolling eyes when Chancellor Merz would be speaking, you cannot say that there's a sort of uniform, homogeneous position of Europe or the EU towards this question of war. With the EU is preparing in official terms for a war against the Russian Federation in 2029, which itself is a very sort of weird narration. But even if that is the narration, the real question is, who is the EU? Is it only Kaja Kallas? Is it only Estonia, the Poles, Baltic countries? Mm-hmm. If you look deeper into the EU, you would see that the southern countries, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, let alone Hungary and Slovakia, even Bulgaria, I mean, there are many countries not sharing this vision.
But Ulrike, can I interrupt here? Because that seems to be like you know, a possibility of actually coming in contact with reality, because when you no longer have the daddy in Washington, then all these children that could have afforded to misbehave when there was an adult in the room will have to contend with the reality of their own situation. So again, if they want to have this war with Russia, so let them have it, because I mean, in this case, perhaps they will have to, you know, tamp down their rhetoric and think more in pragmatic terms. Don't you think that's also a possibility?
The American-European relationship was always the one of primus inter pares, yeah? So the U.S. were the balancing power in Europe. And the moment that the U.S. steps out as primus inter pares or steps out as balancing power of the European countries, and the European countries basically would not know how to organize. I think that's a real danger. I mean, I'm just coming back from France. I had a talk with a very important French political scientist and analysis, these people are analyzing the tendencies underneath the surface of the European Union. And the real question for me and for many others is, will the EU in itself survive its unity when it goes to this war? Yeah, because the more realistic scenario is that the European Union will divide over the question of war. And it will not be united. It will not be homogeneous. And so, again, there's the southern countries, there's Hungary. And even in different terms, the real question is it only the Baltic countries and Poland who are behind that war against Russia? And many other countries want to sneak out of that narration.
When I follow the European discourse, there's a lot of all or nothing rhetoric. So, for example, even now, when you talk about the European unity, you speak a bit about it in somewhat apocalyptic terms. So, for example, will the EU survive or not? But if the EU as a structure, as an organization, is really solid, why can't it afford to step back and, let's say, have some disagreement on the political issue of having a war with Russia and be more coordinated or integrated, let's say, on the social issues or perhaps on the economic issues? I mean, why does it have to be either a total collapse or a total unity? Because that seems like a very sort of, it's a dead end to some extent.
Yeah. No, and I thank you for correcting me on this, but that wasn't the intention, this sort of polarization between sort of implosion, all or nothing, yeah? But the thing is that if you look also on the pictures of what happened in Washington, yeah? There was Mr. Rutte from NATO. There was Mr. Starmer, UK, which is not EU, yeah? So the real question is already why these heads and states and not others, yeah? Because it wasn't an EU thing. If not, why was the UK on board and why was NATO on board? The second question we do need to pose is, what is the congruency between NATO and EU? We saw with the membership of Finland and Sweden that the EU was working on congruency between NATO and EU membership. There's also the question of, in Austria, for instance, whether Austria, neutral today, should join NATO. So the real question, if you say, is it all or nothing, is, what is leaving on the European side if you pull out NATO? Mm-hmm. For instance, I mean, there are also American voices who say, what if America drops out of NATO? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, because there is a lot of people putting NATO in itself into question these days. So all bets are off. But to think that the European Union could go over a deep crisis in major terms about the question on war and peace, which is above all the major question for every political entity, and then just do a better social policy or reduce on agricultural policy, I think this is also not a good analysis, because the European Union has been arguing that the external enemy now produces unity. That was a big argument at the beginning of the war, that because the European Union was never united, nearly or nothing, that the external enemy, meaning Putin, meaning the Russian Federation, would now produce the energy for unification, the energy for mobilizing money, the energy for mobilizing
absolutely
weapons.
And also a pretext of not putting your effort into the very basic and very mundane work of government, because, I mean, to solve all these issues that you have mentioned, you need to be actually working at the governmental level rather than putting all your energies into ideology, which the European Union has been done. Now, can I ask you something else? Because you mentioned this meeting in Washington, and sure, there was a very marked, very obvious difference in the style of reception shown to Putin in Alaska and to the European leaders in Washington. In some case, I think it's difficult for us here in Moscow to distinguish between humility and humiliation of the European leaders. And I wonder, what do you make of this seemingly limitless fawning or servitude on the part of the Europeans. Is it deliberate? Is it effective?
I don't know, but it has been captured in Europe, too, that the heads and states lining up on this bank, waiting on the closed door, waiting for 2 hours, you know, with bilateral talks in Oval Office. I mean, that this was a more radicalizing element, and it did not basically felt like a power projection of Europe or of Mrs. von der Leyen. Yeah. So, but coming back to what you say, implosion, explosion, and why is it so important? The question of war and peace and the question about military engagement of the EU is a question of sovereignty. And because the EU is no state, it has no sovereignty. It's the biggest problem. You talked about the governance structures in the European Union. The question who decides in the EU is not clear. That is the problem of the EU since decades. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always the question, does the EU decide? Do the member states decide? Who decides? And the projection of armed forces, the projection of whatever war setting, yeah, is a question of sovereignty. And as long as this question is not solved, the EU is not capable of doing something. And I think the very question that the EU is now having this narration, yeah, this storytelling, we go, the EU prepares for war against Russia, confronts the EU itself with the question of sovereignty that is unsolved in democratic terms. And that is, I think, a very problematic and difficult sort of tricky point for the European Union because it comes to grips with the fact that as a political entity, it is not functioning.
But Ulrike, again, I mean, if we put it in human terms, I mean, in any family or in any relationship, you try something, it doesn't work, you make a step back, you analyze why it's not working, and you change your strategy. But when the issue of sovereignty is only put at the level of survival, it makes it very difficult for any conscious or, you know, solid analysis to take place, because when your anxieties and fears get into a high gear, it's impossible to properly sit down and analyze. I mean, I wonder if this use of Russia as a sort of unifying, or a war against Russia as a unifying tactic for the EU, was a non-starter from a get-go, because first, Russia has major resources to repel that kind of attack. But second of all, I mean, it could be good as a tactic, a temporary tactic, but can it really solve that issue of sovereignty that you were leading to?
Obviously not. I mean, the whole thing was a non-starter from the very beginning, and many people thought so. I mean, there were many international analysts, but also German analysts, lots of books written about that. First, the story we were telling about this war and its origins, going back to Maidan and everything, that the storytelling was sort of wrong from the very beginning, that we didn't consider context, we didn't consider the co-responsibility of the West in, you know, declenching the war. So if we started, I mean, in the West, and media from a wrong analysis of what was happening in the first place, yeah, the whole story, as you said, was a non-starter since 22nd. And so for me, I mean, for me personally, but I think for many other analysis, the real problem is now the face-keeping solution. How do you move out of this? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if in addition, you now split the US from Europe and Trump is moving apart from sort of the thing and Europe is left alone, it's also left alone with its incapacity. And the even more tragic point here is that nobody can want this. Even not Russia can want this. I mean, even not Russia can want a decomposition, entire composition of the political body of the European Union.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, I think Russians would tell from their own historical experience of, you know, a very painful dissolution of the Soviet Union, for example, or rebuilding of the country after the Second World War, that you grow through frustration. You have to contend with the difficulties that you have on your plate. You have to analyze them, and you have to make efforts to, you know, exchange your make-wish reality for the reality that you actually see in material terms. But Ulrike, let's pause here for a second. We will come back to this fascinating conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
This is it. Moscow. And you know why I'm here? Because when somebody tells me that I cannot report something, it's my nature as a journalist to question why. Why can you tell Ukraine's side of the story, but you can't tell Russia's side of the story? That would be a half-truth. You know another way of saying half-truth? A lie. When Washington or London or whoever tells me I'm not allowed to tell the truth, you know what I do? The opposite. I shine a light on it. That is the Sanchez effect. And I'm Rick Sanchez. Look for it.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ulrike Gerot, founder of the European Democracy Lab. Ulrike, just before the break, you mentioned that Russia wouldn't want the catastrophic dissolution of the European Union. And I think you are absolutely right. To this day, I think Russia wants to find a way of somehow dealing with the European Union. But what I'm hearing from a lot of Russian analysts is that it's a much bigger challenge than even reaching some sort of a deal with the Ukrainians, because at least when it comes to Kyiv, Moscow understands Kyiv's strategic objectives. It disagrees with them, it finds them threatening, but at least it sort of understands the logic. When it comes to Brussels and other European capitals, we are totally in the dark as to what the EU even wants, how it sees the sort of the ideal reality of European continent, because at this point of time, there seems to be very little in terms of even its strategic vision of itself. Do you understand what the European elites at this point are after?
No, I don't. And so are many people, the Russians, but also the Americans don't understand the EU. Again, you know, your last question was you need to go to, difficult times and to analyze what you did wrong. And I think it's now the tragic point for Europe to realize that, again, the question of sovereignty is not dealt with, that it's not clear who decides what in the European Union, and that we need to rethink the system. That's what we tried to do in 2003. I remember that we wanted to do European constitution that would not have solved all the problems, but it would have been much better. And going back to, say, 22 years ago, when we were talking, for instance, about the question whether Europe should become a state, not a super state, but just a functioning state and a democratic state, instead of having the trilogy, like we say, between the Council and the Parliament and the Commission, and it's not clear who decides, the EU, the nation state. And as we see, it's not even clear who is going to Washington, who is not going to Washington. Orban was not in the visit, and Orban would have distinctively different positions on this Ukrainian thing than, for instance, Mr. Merz, So again, you are right, and you point the finger to the very weak point of the European Union, the question of sovereignty, the question of system reform, and what we want to be and what we want to do. And the task is for the Europeans to answer this, and pretty soon. So the question, do you understand what Europe is wanting? No, I don't, because I don't even can say who is speaking on behalf of Europe. Is it Mrs. von der Leyen? Is it Kaya Kallas? Is it Mr. Orban? Or is it Starmer, who interestingly was in the Washington meeting, but Brexit, the UK is no longer in Europe, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, Germany was one of the main foundational states for the EU, and it's also used to be one of the main trading partners for Russia, for this country. And what I find inexplicable in relation to Germany is very distinct hatred for Putin or for Russia, even though when you look at the Russian leader, you don't have to like him. But in many ways, He's acting under the influence of the traditional German culture. He's, you know, orderly. He is meticulous. He's not very much given to this, you know, publicity stunts. So in him, Germany could find somebody to deal with in a predictable fashion, in mutually beneficial fashion, and perhaps also in a somewhat respectful fashion. Because, I mean, that's what we... I think he is one of the most German-like leaders of modern Russia. Why do you think Germany, of all the European countries, hasn't done more to sort of try to prevent the conflict between Russia and Ukraine into going into this kinetic stage? Why do you think the Germans in particular right now carry this very vocal hatred and... distortion of Russia?
I visited Russia this year in June. I spent 2 weeks in St. Petersburg and in Moscow, and I was amazed talking to many intellectuals in, you know, fora and in discussions, how much sympathy still, despite the war setting, the Russian people I met still improved towards Germany. And I'm very thankful for this. Obviously, the Russian language, I don't speak Russian, but, you know, Kassa and Butterbrot, I mean, you know, this cultural connection, Dostoevsky, Bolshoi Theater, I mean, Bismarck, everything that we know about the very deep and in-depth cultural relationship between Germany and Russia makes inexplicable why today, so many years later, there is seemingly no more cultural relation from Germans to Russia. Yeah, most Germans seem completely disconnected from its history, seem not to know what happened in the last century, seem not to know also the liberation, you know, of the Soviet army. And I mean, the sort of the whole look on the history of the last century seems to be torpedoed. And that is why most young Russians, young Germans especially, don't find any connection to today's Russia, which then has most to do with the very fact that most haven't seen Russia never. Yeah. Everybody goes to New York, not to Moscow. So there is a factor of habits, you know, being in cultural cinch with, say, the United States, not in cultural cinch with Russia, forgetting about history, forgetting about Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. So having said this, that makes that most Germans today, as I can experience in my day-to-day sort of, you know, dinner talking, is that they have stereotypes. It's all about stereotypes. Most of the people have never met a Russian, never traveled to Russia, but they know that Putin is evil. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it just works by stereotypes. And the biggest important task, I think, for many intellectuals or investigative journalists in today's Germany or today's France is working against the stereotypes.
When I was growing up as a girl in St. Petersburg, we've been told a lot that Germany has done a lot of soul-searching and reconciliation work following World War II to understand the societal factors that brought the Nazi government to power and allowed it to execute its supremacist ideology. Do you think, looking forward, that soul-searching was really genuinely done? Because if the power of stereotypes remained so high, so effective, that seems that means to me, at least, that you know, the German society didn't really look into the patterns of its own history. If it's ready to malign one state in such a primitive fashion, because many of these stereotypes, they're extremely simple-minded. I mean, they do not take a lot of consciousness to conjure, and yet people believe it. So again, I guess I'm repeating myself. Do you think that soul-searching of Germany post-World War II really happened, or we were mostly, that was another narrative, beautiful narrative to believe in?
Well, I think a lot happened with respect to Israel and the Holocaust, and that was and is for decades a very dominant narrative in which Germany, did analysis what happened, anti-Semitism, and so on and so forth. So I think on this side of the past, there was a lot of work, historical work, intellectual work, work of reconciliation, and obviously of supporting Israel. What you're talking about is basically the state of research on totalitarianism today, where it stands. Yeah, and because the going over World War II, the importance of the Soviet army for liberating Germany, the late entry of the U.S., and still we are telling that the U.S. are liberating Europe. Yes. You know, so there is so much, say, bias about what happened really in World War II, and the very fact that this is so has much to do with the division of Germany and with the division that two countries had two stories. Obviously, we had the GDR with the anti-imperialistic sort of, formation of state, and then the Western Germany. And I think this makes that the soul searching basically would take in two countries with distinct soul searching elements. Mm-hmm. And now today, in United Germany, you need also to realize that the eastern part of the country is much more Russia friendly and understanding, and much more against the war of Europe against Russia than the western part is. Mm-hmm. So it's not only the fact that there's a soul searching experience. I think it has much to do with the division of the two countries and with everything surrounding these, 40 years of separation that now makes it so difficult to go back to the ancient tradition of German-Russian relations.
I see. One thing I would add here is that I think Eastern Germany is not so much Russia-friendly as it is history-friendly or history-conscious.
Yeah.
And I do want to end our interview on one more question about this divide between East and West of Germany. It is pretty apparent in voting patterns, I think, in cultural attitudes as well. How do you see it developing over time? Do you think it's going to deepen, or do you think perhaps that East Germany could serve as that sort of bridge for Russia and united Germany going forward?
Well, I mean, when you corrected me saying former GDR is not Russia-friendly but history-friendly, that's the point. I think there's a real point about understanding history in Germany. Yeah, and obviously there's a tendency also with these algorithms and smartphones and so that we are connected from history. I mean, there's a real also in empirical data, what do people know? Yeah, do young Germans know who was Adenauer and who was Hitler? And, I mean, the percentages of young Germans who know history is really slim, and it's a problem, because if you don't know your history, you cannot design your future. So yes, there is a problem. And what is my perspective? I think, and that's on the positive side, the war in Ukraine has declenched a lot. What I can detect is that in many fora, in many so-called alternative media and so, I think there is now a tendency in re-looking back at history, what did happen in the fascist area, what did happen in World War II, and that the tendency who now writes, look, can we look again at what was happening, and is the story that was told to us, is it the only true story, that this is put into question? And here again, it's very interesting that the Eastern and the Western Germans are doing this not in cinch, but in very sort of critical discussions, and I think that can help. So to make it on a positive term, I think there is an emerging new discussion, but it will need much time so as to be a little bit broadened and to allow that you have new teaching formats, perhaps new school books written. I mean, a new look on our own past. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think we are in the process, or let's say, I hope we are in the process.
Well, I join you in that hope, and thank you very much for being with us today and engaging in this very important discussion.
Many thanks to you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.